Welcome to the Dildorks, dorky discourse on sex, dating, and masturbating. My name is Kate Sloan. I'm a sex journalist, a sex blogger, and I'm slowly wading into the land of non-monogamy. Ooh. Who are you, friend?
I'm Bex. I'm a sex educator and a blogger, and I am like a queer poly slut.
Cool.
And we have another guest here with us today.
Oh my god, I'm so excited for our guest today. Oh my god. Can you please, this is the amazing Andre Shakti. Would you please tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. So my name is Andre Shakti. I am from the East Coast originally, now residing in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I am a professional slut. Which encompasses many things, but mostly I'm a sex worker, sex educator, and I'm a journalist who writes primarily about sex and the sex industry from an intersectional point of view.
Awesome. And like the thing that I have been watching most closely lately that you do is your column about polyamory, which is called
so good.
It's so good. It's called I Am Poly and So Can You, which I love as a title. And I find it so interesting because I feel like one of the biggest issues with becoming a polyamorous or non-monogamous person is that we don't have like cultural scripts and models for like what those relationships are supposed to look like. So like a lot of us do need advice. Could you tell us a bit about like the column and like how it got started?
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, just like you said, I feel like the two most important things that adults need to know, you know, once we've evolved into adulthood and we have like our own autonomy and agency, are number one, how to manage money, and number two, how to navigate and sustain relationships with other people. And we don't learn how to do either one of those things in school when we're growing up. So nope. I'm like, no wonder most adults are such a fucking mess. So the column, and I'm much better at managing my sex stuff than I am my money stuff to this day, for the record. So the column started about a year, 2 years ago now. I don't even know what day of the week it is, let alone what year we're in. About a year and a half ago, I started really doing journalism about 2.5 years ago, just to supplement my sex industry income. And shortly after that, I was approached by a person named Jetta Ray, who had recently been hired to be the editor of an intersectional online feminist magazine called Harlot. And Harlot was launching in January 2016, and they wanted me to come on as one of the staff writers and also have a bi-monthly column about polyamory. And so Jetta knew that I had been polyamorous for a number of years, knew that I did a lot of writing and education around it already, and thought that I might be game, and she was totally right. And so I wrote I Am Poly and So Can You, which is totally like credit her for the title. I did not come up with the name of the column. I ran that column through Harlot until Harlot folded in like August. It had a very powerful, passionate, short run of the things. It was a startup company first and foremost, and like many startups, and unfortunately went under last summer. And I really wanted to keep the column running because it was so well received with a lot of columns. And I didn't even know this until I started talking to other people who write advice columns. But a lot of columns in the beginning, they kind of have to generate their own questions, whether they're like literally making them up or they're like calling them from their close friends or family, just because the column doesn't have, you know, the traffic or the attention yet. And I have never had to make up a single question for my poly column because people were just like, oh my God, yes. Like they were so stoked about it because there are a lot of columns out there that are sexuality related that encompass non-monogamy, but there are none that currently have either like the exclusive or the primary focus being addressing non-monogamous relationships. So I really wanted to fill that void, and I tried to shop the column around to a bunch of other publications that I work for, no one was really interested in it. And to be honest, it was kind of like the election cycle that motivated me to not even specifically get this like non-monogamy project off the ground, but just get like all of my passion projects off the ground. Because I'm like, hey, the world's going to end sometime really soon. Like, I don't want to die if I haven't fulfilled my passion projects. So I just decided to launch it myself, and it's been running for the past 2.5 months now at a separate URL at iampoly.net, and people can submit questions. They can see all the archives. Everything's free and accessible to the public, and I have a Patreon account that corresponds with it and also gives a little more history about me and why I think this kind of education and this kind of access is so important, and you know, also to help bolster me financially, because it is a labor of love, you know, first and foremost. So
yeah, I think what you're saying about it really filling a void makes a lot of sense, because like, as a queer trans poly person, I always feel like people need a glossary to even understand what's happening in my life, let alone give me advice about it.
Yeah. And
having someone who like is poly and lives in those circles, and I can just like roll stuff out, and they would be like, oh yeah, been there, you know, like I think that's a really important person to have giving advice in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like you don't have to write. A lot of folks have told me, you know, when they write into columns, or they write into they even just like calling their friends, right, and asking for advice about relationships. There are so many, just the vocabulary alone, I refer to it as people having context for my life. So yeah. Like when I need advice, advice or resources or something from friends, I have to go to the friends that have the context for whatever that thing is that I'm going to ask. Cause that way then I don't have to roll out a whole fucking lecture ahead of whatever, you know, simple question I have to ask them. And, it's been really, powerful for people to be able to use like, queer rhetoric, sex worker rhetoric, gender nonconforming rhetoric, you know, acronyms or otherwise, and not feel like they have to like hold my hand and walk me through you know, what their situation looks like in order to get a quality response. So
yeah, and I mean, like, I've even had this with therapists. Like, I'll talk about, you know, something that's happening in one of my poly relationships, and the therapist is like, so you're jealous? And I'm like, no, there's more nuance to that. And they're like, okay, but, like, so what about jealousy in this relationship?
And I'm like, they're like, so, okay, yes. Have you ever considered monogamy? Maybe this just isn't, like, the right thing for you, and you're just like, ah, God, that's
like, there's nuance to emotions, like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ah.
Yeah, it can be really hard. I mean, I've had a really hard time finding therapists. This is kind of, I think some people who know me in real life who will listen to this will already know this story, but I was looking for you know, I too need relationship counseling and coaching. I'm not like above everything. I'm a human being, and I was looking for that. I went through a pretty significant breakup about 2.5 years ago with a long-term partner. And we looked for couples counselors before we broke up to try and address it. And then after we broke up, I wanted to go into counseling for anxiety related stuff, but also to get some additional insight into navigating kind of what I really wanted out of a polyamorous configuration. And I went through 7 therapists. And not because I'm like an asshole, or you know, it was because people kept recognizing me. And I kept violating people's code of ethics. So the first 2 therapists I went to recognized me from porn within the first session, and then had to like leave because they were interns. They had to like leave and consult their people. And then their people were like, yeah, you can't see this person anymore. And then the next therapist I went to had attended a workshop of mine that I had taught at a Dark Odyssey adult kink weekend event, and felt like that was an inappropriate connection. Another person found me on Facebook and saw that we had like 17 friends in common, and they were all like queer sexual revolutionary types, and thought that was too close. So like, I've had a lot of trouble finding mental health resources, just because you wanna walk that line. When you're a queer person, you wanna walk that line of finding somebody who is qualified, you know, to handle to advise you and to coach you and counsel you. But you want to find someone who is savvy in all the things, right? Who's savvy in trans issues and poly issues and kink issues, et cetera. Mm-hmm. However, you can't know them, right? Like you can't like they have to be all the things, but you have to be that rare, like sheltered queer that like isn't well connected and like doesn't have a big network and that they might fall under. And so it's a really fine line. It's really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the same ethics with the advice column. Advice columns, no one gives a fuck what I do or what courage I
say. Yeah.
I'm curious if there are any questions that come up like over and over and over again in the submissions you receive for the column.
Oh yeah, the two most frequent kinds of questions that I get are number one, anything regarding jealousy, just mm-hmm. like anything. Usually because most people think that if they haven't done a whole lot of work on themselves around polyamory, they think that jealousy means that they're failing at non-monogamy and that they immediately it's not suited for them mm-hmm. and it's the wrong decision. And so folks oftentimes contact me during like their first like jealousy crisis and they're having this like existential like, is this right for me, is it not, am I a terrible person, am I not, you know, am I doing poly wrong?
I felt a feeling.
Exactly. Like I'm like, you're not a robot, you're allowed to have emotions. So a lot of it is just like basically giving people permission to experience jealousy and trying to remove a lot of like the shame and the stigma away from the word jealousy, and also encourage, instead of a fear or anxiety response when we feel jealousy coming on, encourage people to see it more as an opportunity to learn more about yourself and share more of yourself with your partner. Mm-hmm. And just see it as a perfectly natural human emotion that can be conquered and worked through and navigated. So that is number one. And I would say number two are folks contacting me about interpersonal relations with their partner's partners, mm-hmm. aka metamors, which is a word that always makes me think of the mythical creature, the Minotaur. Well, like the big bullheaded dude that like lives in like, the labyrinth and like chases you. Like that's like what I think of when I hear metamor, and I'm just
anytime I have a metamor that I haven't met, now that's what I'm gonna picture.
Well, because like part of the issue that comes up with metamors is like sometimes you think of them as being not really a person. Like you can kind of like build them up as this sort of like mythical creature in your head, so it makes perfect sense.
Yeah. That's why my style of polyamory has always very much been a family style polyamory, family style restaurant. I don't need all of my people by any means to be like all like romantically or sexually involved with one another, though if they want to be, awesome. But I do need the people in my life that are my partners to be able to share space with one another, to be able to if I have an event or I go out to dinner, I should be able to invite all the people, and they should be to an extent invested in each other's health and happiness and well-being, and invested in my individual relationships with these other people to a certain extent. And that's been more difficult for some people than others. I'd say it's more difficult for folks who are just starting out as poly, because again, they come into it with all of these preconceived notions about it. And one of those notions is that, you know, if my partner's dating somebody else, like I don't want to know about it. Like they're not going to want to know about who I'm dating. They're not going to hear about it at all. The more they hear about it, the more it's going to hurt them, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, one of the great things about that family style poly is the more you get to know your partner's people, the more human and relatable and flawed they become mm-hmm. in your eyes, and the less you make them out to be this kind of like deity that you will like never, you know, compare to. And it's actually a lot healthier. So I always encourage people to err on the side of more exposure to their partners.
How do you usually navigate that, like, initial meeting? Because I'm sure that can be really stressful for a lot of them sometimes.
Totally. So I always, I'm like, I have so much experience with this. I identify as polysaturated is my identity. So I usually pick a neutral location. Like, I don't have people over to... I won't invite folks over to my place. I won't go over to someone else's place. I pick, like, you know, like a bar, or like maybe we'll all go to a comedy show and then we'll get a drink, or maybe we'll go to, you know, go see like an art show or like something that like we all are interested in. And I'll take it to like a neutral location. I will also encourage my, so let's say I am introducing my new person to my current partner, pre-existing partner. So I will encourage my pre-existing partner to bring one of his people or her people along. So that way it's four of us and not three of us. And that way I don't feel like I'm constant. I am, cause I have like this like hostess brain where I just want to like constantly make sure everyone's having a good time. And like, are you doing okay? Are you doing okay? Do you need anything? Do you need anything? So it's as much for myself. So I like, there like with my person to like be a bolster for them, but also for them so that they don't, you know, look at me with my shiny new person and think like, oh my gosh, like, you know, is like, I'm feeling left out. I'm feeling, you know, lonely. If they get to bring someone of their own, so to speak, then that kind of levels out the playing field and makes them feel more supported. So that's like my ideal way of kind of doing that first interaction.
That's really interesting. I just met one of my metamors recently for the first time, and I was like really stressed out about it, but it was actually fine. And I feel like that's how it's gone every time I've done that. I've like really built it up in my mind, and then it was like completely 100% fine.
Yeah, well, because the other person is doing the same thing. Like, more often than not, like, you just have to understand, like, the other person is doing the exact same thing. You know, they're over on the other side being like, oh my gosh, like, you know, like, oh, I'm the new kid on the block, you know, like, I don't have any standing yet. Like, I'm super intimidated by this other, my person's other partner, because they've been together for such and such years. And like, they're such a happy, badass couple, and, you know, da, 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 da. So like, no matter what the situation is, our minds are amazing, and we can work up, conjure up any level of anxiety to meet any creative situation.
Like, yeah, it's definitely my brain's superpower.
Yeah.
Can I be anxious about this? Hold my beer.
For real, it's so ridiculous. It's so, so ridiculous, because like, when I hear it from other people, because I've had one of my partners has occasionally, I tend to date folks who are like more naturally monogamously oriented, like monogamish. So they tend to like start dating me, and then maybe they have like one other person on the side, but usually they're pretty content with just having like one main partner and then maybe like a little size, like a side squeeze. And I'm much more like active generally, dating wise than my partners are. And yeah, I mean, like, the narratives that I can run in my head, I mean, it's amazing. It's like, I wrote a piece a while back about like femme competitiveness and queer relationships. And I kind of said this like paraphrase in the article where I'm like, you know, if the other, especially if it's another femme for me, if the other femme is like, in graduate school, I will start thinking that I'm not smart. She's smarter than me, right? Yeah. If she has red hair, I will be like, oh my gosh, does my partner actually prefer redheads? But if she is younger than me, I'll be like, oh my god, she's younger than me. Like, you know, she doesn't have any lines on her face, like, blah, blah. If she's older than me, then I'm like, oh wow, she's like so much more experienced. Like, I can make up anything. I can come up with any reason. And it's so, so silly. Because I hear the same thing from my partners, other people, when they meet me. Like, a lot of times we'll hang out a few times and they'll be like, listen, I just want to let you know you were super intimidating and I was really scared to meet you because of, you know, all the work you do or whatever. And I'm always so like humbled by that. Like that's such a humbling and human, you know, it's a very relatable feeling and experience. Yeah,
totally. Okay, so we've been talking a lot about jealousy and the opposite of jealousy, so say some poly people, is compersion. I was wondering if you have any tips for, like, working toward fostering compersion, because that's something that I am definitely struggling with right now.
Oh, God. I actually also struggle really heavily with compersion, and I find that for me personally, the better I'm doing overall in my life, like the fuller my life is, the more satisfied I feel about where I am in life. And like, you know, this could be health related, this could be, you know, financial stability, career stability, et cetera. The more secure and stable I'm feeling in general, the more capacity for compersion that I seem to have. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed this like direct correlation between that. But if I'm going through an anxiety period, or I'm like stressed about money, or something's happening with my housing stability that's throwing me off kilter, I will respond very differently, or I have the capacity to respond very differently to similar situations that I otherwise would be like very cheerleady about. Mm-hmm. And I kind of just try and be, because I know this about myself, I try and plan for, make contingency plans for when this happens. And I let my partners know that this is how I operate. So that way they can anticipate a little more, support and investment in, when I'm feeling, you know, generally like better. And then when they notice I'm going through a hard time, they will intentionally try and make things a little easier for me, either with, you know, either how often they see their other people, or, you know, what they ask or how much they ask of me around them seeing their other people. And yeah, that's kind of how it works for in my relationships. I've had a lot of trouble with it. I'm very, very transparent about, you know, the fact that I, again, am like superhuman, and I'm not superhuman. I'm super human.
Yeah.
I think that's really important. And I think it's a problem we have in any group that isn't like part of the majority, whether it's queerness or poly or kinky or whatever. You get a lot of people having to create the illusion that it's always perfect, and like, yes, and we always feel compersion and we're always happy for each other, and jealousy, like, always you get people that are like, you know, don't you get jealous? And the people are like, no, it's great, it's wonderful over here. And generally when people ask about, I tell people that like poly is just as hard as monogamy, the challenges are just easier for me to cope with. Like, they're the challenges that work for me, versus monogamy challenges are more of a struggle for me to get around. But it's still, like, difficult, just in different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I will also say that something that really has helped me with compersion is how my partners present their people to me and how they talk about their people. And so, for example, I'm going to like equate this to sex work, because why not? So in the sex industry, you know, two things happen when mainstream media tries and talks about the sex industry. They either talk about it in like a victimizing or criminalizing way, or they talk about it in like a glamorizing and exotifying way. So like either, you know, we're all like pushing needles into our arms with daddy issues, or we are like rolling around in fur coats with like $100 bills covering our bodies. And people tend to describe their partners, their other partners, to their pre-existing partners in either either one of those ways. So either they will describe them, they will only talk about their positive attributes, like, oh, I'm so excited to go out with this person, they're so wonderful, here's this wonderful thing they did, here's this other wonderful thing they did, here's what I love about them, because they think the more positive they see their, the happier their partner sees that they are with this person, the more they can vouch for this person and how cool and awesome and, you know, like legitimate they are, the better it'll be. Mm-hmm. Or they describe the partner in like the other person in like negative terms to their, you know, pre-existing or maybe primary partner, in a way of reassuring them. So they're like, oh yeah, I mean, they're really cool, but like, you know, they do this thing that really annoys me, you know, here, and then they're really bad with time management. That's like really obnoxious. And like, also the way they talk, I mean, I could never be like a long-term partner of theirs or anything. And we use this like, this rhetoric to like reassure our other people. And in reality, when we like hit either one of those binaries, it does way more harm than good, because it either makes that person look like they're a saint, or it makes it look like we have terrible taste in people. And like, why would we be like interested in this horrible individual that like we never have anything to say about them, you know? And it also teaches each other that the only way to build somebody up is to tear somebody else down. Mm-hmm. Right. So mm-hmm. I encourage my partners, and I will have to check myself sometimes, to present other partners in a very multifaceted humanistic way, and like a very holistic way. So I'll be like, here are some really awesome things about this person. Here are some things that like aren't super awesome about this person. Like, here's why I think it's worth me dating them, you know? And I try and balance it out in how I communicate my people to each other. And that way they don't feel confused or intimidated or like, what the fuck is she doing with this terrible human? Like, so. Yeah. Does that all make sense? I don't even.
Yeah.
Is that totally? Yeah, definitely. Okay, I think that kind of comes back to when we were talking about making sure to, like, humanize them, mm-hmm. you know, and making sure that they're not this minotaur metamor, that they're, like, an actual human. I'm using that from now on. Just, like, yeah.
So, you're actually a fisting expert. We are big fans of fisting here on the Dildorks.
I knew I liked you guys on occasion.
you teach workshops on it. Actually, from what I understand, you and Bex maybe met at a fisting workshop.
I think we met at a strap-on.
Oh, I have been to one of your fisting workshops, and we also met at a strap-on workshop.
Oh, okay. Well, our memorable meeting was at the strap-on workshop. I was actually just telling my partner, I was like, so yeah, I know this person because I needed demos for this class, and so I cleverly wrote alphabet, you know, letters on the back of the index cards that I handed out to everyone in case they had questions they wanted to submit anonymously. And then at the end of the class, I surprised people by calling out random letters and then pulling them up in front of the classroom to do a fully clothed, non-sexual demo, because unfortunately the space we were in did not allow for a proper demonstration. And Bex actually was the first person that I called on, and they were so wonderful and like engaged. So I'm like, I'm just gonna keep them up here for the rest of it. So
there were no complaints on my part.
Well, yeah, right. You look like you were having a terrible time.
Oh yeah.
Of me like fake fucking your face, like I'm like, oh, Bex is like laying fully clothed spread eagle on this like hotel conference floor, and they're all people like crowded around, and I'm like straddling their face, like holding a dildo and like smacking them in the face with it, like this. And that's how you meet people in our industry.
Yeah,
these folks are.
That was at Sex Down South, and I'm super bummed it's not happening this year.
Oh, not more bummed than we are. Trust me, we really tried for a few months to get to seal a location down for it. But it's some kind of crazy conference is taking over like all of the hotels in downtown Atlanta during that.
They can't have all of Atlanta.
I need to be kinky perps. I'm not around there. Like, I'm actually the only member of the Sex Down South team that doesn't live in Atlanta. So, like, I just accept what they tell me. Like, when they tell me there are no venues, I'm like, you guys would know better than I would. Like, I
just, yeah. I mean, I believe them. I'm just objecting to the fact that this other con bought a city, apparently.
Yeah. Like, you know, they're probably not people of color. That's all I'm
saying. Mm. Yep. Not sure people of color.
But yeah, fisting. So
yeah. Yeah. So
I went to the first Sex Down South, I went to your fisting workshop, and me and my sir, who was not my sir at the time, were definitely, like, sitting in the front row with the biggest smiles, just like, yes, talk to us about fisting.
And tell was us that the things. One that I, like, ran in and I was like, I didn't know I was teaching this class today? Yes. Was that? Yes. Oh my god, okay.
Yes, yeah. That one.
So, these Atlanta people, like, they're gonna laugh at me because these fucking Atlanta Sex Down South people that I love dearly, they handle all the logistics for the conference, and they totally changed the schedule like 4 days before the conference our first year. Because it's the first year we're working all the kinks out, right? But I, coming in from California, I printed out my schedule. I wrote down my class times in my calendar, like, you know, 2 weeks ahead of time, and I didn't recheck the program. And I remember that morning at, like, I, like, got in at like 10 o'clock at night. I didn't go to bed till like 2 in the morning because I was like getting settled. I wake up at 9. I'm like super proud of myself. I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna start my day early. I'm gonna like get all my stuff together. Maybe I'll check out some classes. And I'm like, I guess I should look at the schedule and see what classes are happening today. And I look at and my class is literally starting in 5 minutes. And I was like, ah! I didn't shower, like, threw clothes on, grabbed, like, a notebook, and, like, ran downstairs and just taught it off the cuff. Because I didn't have any of my work printed. I didn't have, like, anything. And I was so embarrassed. I was, like, so self-conscious.
It was such a good workshop, though. And I know it was, like, it was supposed to be, like, fisting and hand sex, and you made it, like, halfway through, and you're like, you're all here for the fisting, huh? That's... We were just like, yeah!
So I'm looking around the room, I'm like, y'all are already doing hand sex. Like, you have hand sex written on your faces right now. Like, let's just get to the...
Yes.
But so
I'm so glad that's your experience. It's always so like reassuring to hear from an educator perspective when you go into something having like, you know, some stuff happening in the background of your life and you make it through a class and you're like, wow, everyone probably hates me because I probably totally messed that class up. And then people are like, that was the best thing ever. And you're like, wow, okay.
Aww. Yeah, no, it was awesome. And I definitely like, my sir had, like, told me he was going to the con, and he's like, you should go, and I'm like, oh, it's super soon, I don't know if I could throw stuff together, and I looked at the schedule, and I was like, oh, Andre's teaching a fisting workshop, I'm gonna go to this, I'm going there. This is definitely one of the ones I was really excited about, and it didn't disappoint.
Awesome.
So Bex has been fisted, but I have not.
I have not!
I thought you...
I have almost.
Oh, okay. I have been misled, I suppose.
Very close. And then so my IUD got bumped, and I was like, okay, we're not... Nope.
I thought you took a fist in your butt after that.
No!
Oh my god, okay. All this time,
butt?
I thought...
You're very impressed with my butt. I don't... I mean, maybe could, but, like, no.
Okay,
impressed or obsessed...
I mean, whatever. It's a good butt.
No, oh my God, I honestly, true. I thought that you had passed this milestone without me, and now I feel...
I fisted other people.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
So, neither of us have been fisted. So,
all right, so the rest of this podcast is going to be, we're going to take a break for a few hours, I'm going to fly out to Kate and Jeff, and then I'm going to fist them, and then we'll come back, and you'll tell us how it was. That's
oh my god.
Perfect.
I'm going to clear my schedule.
No, I'm actually rarely, even though I know so much about it, I'm rarely people's first fist because I do have really big hands. I have disproportionately large hands. So it actually is very difficult for like newbies to get fisted by me. So I will say that. Downside.
So like, wow. So we're sex educators, so we know like use a lot of lube and go slowly and communicate. One of the things that I get nervous about with fisting, since I already kind of know all that other stuff, is like kind of the emotional aspect of it. Like I'm kind of worried that I'll get like emotionally overwhelmed and it'll feel like too much. Like, is that a thing that happens?
Totally. I never cried during sex. And when I say cry during sex, I mean in a cathartic way, not like in a trauma way. Mm-hmm. But like I never had like any kind of like positive, like cathartic release during sex until I got fisted. And the first time I ever got fisted, like I literally, their hands, like I came, I had like the most powerful orgasm I'd ever had, and their hand came out and I fucking lost it. And I was just like bawling, and I had to like, you know, through the tears, you're like reassuring your partner. You're like, I'm okay. It's a good cry. It's good. But it totally happens. It's such an intense experience, both for like the person giving as well as the person receiving. And, it absolutely can bring up a lot of emotion. Mm-hmm. A lot of emotion, a lot of release. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing or anything to be scared of, as long as, you know, your partner is aware ahead of time that you feel like this might happen and they're, you know, they're not going to be caught totally off guard and afraid they just like severely injured you or something like that. And like that cry.
Yeah. But, yeah.
Totally happens.
Yeah. I'm curious, as like a fisting aficionado or an aficionado, I guess. I'm curious if you have favorite accoutrement and tools that you like to use for fisting, as far as like lube or like gloves or like any particular ones that you love for that.
Yeah, so I would say it's funny because I'm like, some of my partners I'm fluid bonded with, some of them I'm not, and some of the ones I'm fluid bonded with who get fisted actually prefer if I use a glove, because they say they enjoy the sensation more. Mm-hmm. Than if it's just my skin. They say it's slippery, and I'm like slippery. And then other people who like, you know, other people that I'm fluid bonded with, they're like, oh my god, do not put a glove on, like, because they say that it feels like there's a not friction, but there's like a pulling, like a lagging kind of sensation. And so everybody is different. If folks are going to go with gloves, I mean, obviously just make sure your partner doesn't have a latex allergy ahead of time if you're going to use latex. Black Dragon, like nitrile tattooing gloves are like my favorite go-to sex gloves in general.
And they're so sexy.
So
exactly. So many people, like, I work in a sex shop and like I'll mention gloves and they're like, gloves for sex, and I'm like, you live a very different life than I do.
There's that, like, my favorite, well, I won't say my favorite part, one of my favorite parts about fisting, if I'm topping, is just like that snap. It's just like,
yes.
And you just snap it and you like make eye contact with the person and then they just like melt into like a puddle. Whatever.
Yeah. It's so good.
Or like, you know, the alternative is like I'm just like stretching my hand out beforehand and they're like, oh fuck. So, and the same thing goes for lube. Like, some people are you know, diehard silicone lube. I only use silicone. Some people are diehard water-based lube. I only use water-based. Some people out here in California are like, I only use coconut oil, or I only use, you know, whatever other like natural, organic, holistic, locally sourced bull fucking people pull out of their gardens at home. I will say I go back and forth. My favorite water-based lube, if my person has a water-based preference, is definitely Sassy by Slickwood.
Mm-hmm. I love that one.
Just because it's so thick. It's like perfect. It's made for anal sex and fisting. And then I'm a there's not that much differentiation in silicone lube, but I've always been a Swiss Navy fan, is my favorite silicone. I've recently gotten on the Pure train too. I think the brand I have their water based and their silicone. I like them a lot. But what else? Oh, what I was gonna say in terms of like accessories is oftentimes I'll recommend for folks who are having trouble taking something of a larger size inside of them, and they want to like they're like, how do I work up to a fist? Like, how do I train my body? Inflatable toys are like my favorite fucking thing because it's number one, it's way cheaper to go out and buy an inflatable insertable toy than it is to go out and buy like five different toys of like, you know, elevating
sizes. And length.
And it also is a really fun, especially if like you're a little kinky and you're into like power play, it's fun to like put an inflatable toy in and then give like your partner the bulb to like make it bigger. So those are like some of my favorite ones. I get mine here at Mr. S Leather in San Francisco, but I think Stockroom also has some of them available online as well. Yeah.
I'm also really excited to have my partner use like massive toys on me as like fisting warm up. I think that that's going to be fun. I probably have some toys that are like bigger than his fist. So
And you can also buy fist shape. I think Oxballs actually sells a fist shape. I mean, a lot of people sell fist toys, but Oxballs in particular has a, I'm like just thinking in my head, I've seen like a red like silicone.
Yeah, the red plug thing.
Yep. So there are actually like, because the only problem with training with toys is they really don't prepare you for the shape a hand makes. Like that kind of triangular or like diamond shape with the knuckles being the widest in the center kind of shape. Like that still oftentimes is challenging for folks the first few times, even if they have been practicing with toys. So if you can get your hands on and it's accessible to you to get an actual fist molded shaped toy, it actually helps.
That makes a lot of sense. I always worried about the plugs, though, because, like, the fingers can't curl back down once it's inside. Like, you have to have the whole length. And, like, when I've fisted other people, I always found that once you're getting towards the end, it's, like, curling your fingers that make you able to get your whole fist in, you know?
Those toys are definitely better for anal fisting or vaginal fisting, because obviously like the ass is just like a long tube, so you can anally fist somebody. When you anally fist somebody, your fingers don't curl because the cervix isn't there to cap it, so your hand actually stays like that the whole time unless you're punch fucking. I'm like people can't see this. I'm like on Skype, like punch fucking.
I'm appreciating it. I'm into it.
It's fine.
But yeah, if you're doing vaginal fisting or front hole fisting, absolutely, your fingers at some point, depending on how deep somebody's hole is, are going to curl at some point when they're in. So, yeah,
I just feel so gleeful when discussing fisting. Like, it's just like it has this like emotional like magic to me that just like draws me to it over so many other sex acts. I don't know what it is. Like, I think I just think it's going to be like really intimate and like emotionally transformative, and like maybe I'm building it up too much in my head, but I feel like a lot of people who I talk to about it do talk about it as like kind of a transformative thing.
You will, if this isn't you already, because I don't want to make any like assumptions about either one of your sexual orientations, but when you get fisted, you will realize exactly how unnecessary men are. Let's just call it your coming to Jesus moment. It's pretty fucking, and that I'm not gonna lie, like the political implications of it, like how radical it is on a political level to to be, you know, to have women or people who don't identify as any gender that doesn't identify as cis male, penetrating each other in that way and like creating, creating such like pleasure in that way and intensity in that way. Yeah, I also hate kids. So like, I have no interest in procreation. So I'm just like, why are men here? Like, why?
Right, why are they?
Like, it'll be like be
who
fun.
Invited you?
So good. It's like Wonder. Did you guys see Wonder Woman?
Not yet.
Not yet. Oh, okay. Me too. I know.
There's that for people who have seen it at this point. There's a quote that whatever the hell her name is, Gal Gadot, says that is laying with Chris Pine on a boat when they're leaving like the magical Lady Island, and she has this great little like dialogue with him, and it's just like the most feminist fucking part of the movie, and it's beautiful. You know exactly what I'm talking about when you hear it.
I need to go see it soon.
Yeah,
For me, honestly, fisting too. I look at it almost like I figure athletes probably look at the Olympics. Like, this awesome thing that I can do, and I just want to see if I can do it. Like, I just, you know, like, for me, it's not even so much an intimacy thing.
Like, I'll mail you a gold medal so that.
Yes! Yes! It's just like, you know, I'm a nerd. It's like achievement unlocked. Like, I want to be able to do the thing. So that's where a lot of, and like, sometimes I forget how radical it is, and I made, like, I was going through my bag and I had a fisting hanky in there, so the red hanky, and in front of my vanilla friends, and like, someone made a comment, and I was like, oh yeah, you know, fisting hanky, blah, 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 and their eyes just got really wide. I was like, what? And they were like, have you fisted people? And I was like, yeah, and they just like silently hugged me and walked away. And I was like, okay.
Yeah, it's so scary to so many people. And I think there's two elements to that. I think it's like scary because when we, and I'm using the royal we, when we think about when we hear fisting, we think fist. And in our in the collective mind, a closed fist is a symbol of violence. So, folks who are not familiar, who maybe aren't as weren't raised in such a sex positive environment or a sexually progressive environment, and or haven't discovered their own bodies yet, or their own pleasure, investigated their own pleasure yet. They, especially if they've been victims or survivors of sexual trauma or assault, sometimes fisting is something that's really hard for them to wrap their heads around because they can't, just like people have trouble separating sex trafficking from consensual legal age sex work, it's really hard for people to separate. I mean, lots of different forms of kink and BDSM play from it being a violent, non-consensual act. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of empathy for those people. Like, I can very easily see how that mental jump would be hard to make. So just like having a lot of patience and good humor with people who are really like freaked out by it, and just, you know, working to normalize fisting in the mainstream consciousness one hole at a time.
This is just a beautiful mission.
I know.
That is a gorgeous note on which to end the show, I think. Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us, Andre. This was such an illuminating conversation. We're talking about two of my favorite things in the world, polyamory and fisting.
Just... Those are two of my favorite things. Basically, like, my entire life are, like, Hitachi magic wands, fisting, wrestling, and polyamory. And that can just sum up, like, me in a nutshell.
There is literally a magic wand next to me.
Yes! There are four in my bedroom. There are four vibrators. Technically one of them is a doxy, but there are currently four large vibrators in my bedroom right now.
You're doing things right.
I think so. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much for having me on. Can I plug my...
Yes, please. I was right about to. Yeah.
Awesome. I know, you're professionals. I should have known. So again, my name is Andre Shakti, spelled phonetically, but in case that's confusing to you, it is AndreShakti. You can find me on Facebook or on Twitter as Andre Shakti. I'm on FetLife as Andre Shakti, but I probably won't message you back because I'm on there very infrequently. And you can follow my work at iampoly.net. You can follow my Patreon, become a what they call a patron of my Patreon at patreon.com/iampoly. And yeah, I'm an open book. Hit me up. Thanks so much for having me.
I have been Kate Sloan. You can find my sex blog at girlyjuice.net and the rest of my writing at katewritesaboutsex.com. And you can also follow me on Twitter and Instagram at girly_juice. Where is your stuff at?
I'm Bex. You can find me at bextalksex.com and at bextalksex on Twitter and Instagram. Together, we're the Dildorks. We're at thedildorks.com, at thedildorks on Twitter and Instagram, and at patreon.com/thedildorks. You can also find us on your favorite podcasting app. And do us a favor while you're there, rate and review us. It makes us easier to find for other people looking for really cool, dorky things.
Thank you so much to Protodome for letting us use his song I Want You in My Bedroom as our theme song. And thank you also to Amy Gardner, who is at starboots_ on Twitter, for doing our logo for us. And of course, thank you again to Andre Shakti for being the most amazing guest on this episode of our show.
Yes!
Until next time, folks, get out there and live your sexy, dorky life. Bye! Bye.
Cool, I'm ready.
Okay.
And once we start recording, like if you ever need to like pause for a second or whatever, we do edit. So if you need to like pause and say something else or whatever, it's not.
Yeah.
You don't have to do it straight through.
Yeah. Awesome. If I have to pee, I don't have to like take the computer into the bathroom with me and like,
yeah, exactly.
Turn it into a fetish clip all of a sudden.
It's a whole different kind of podcast.
Okay, cool. Let me know if you guys want to bridge that gap at any time. I'm here for you.
Okay, good to know. Thank you.